Okay, we are going to get started. Can you guys hear me okay? Now you can hear me. I don't like standing behind a podium, but I might need to. You are in helping children and teens deal with loss. Hopefully this is the one you want to be in right now. How many of you guys were in my last breakout that were just in here? Okay, not too many. Good, because I'll repeat a few stories. I didn't mean that in a bad way, by the way. Sorry. So, as you can imagine, there are many faces to what loss may look like with kids. I love group interactions, so feel free to interrupt me or ask questions, or I'll stop and see if you guys are all still awake and having your caffeine and ask you questions. Because I really want this to be practical more than just theoretical. I work a lot with children and families. I have 5 children of my own. So it is important to me that we're really thoughtful about how you do it well with kids and teens. And obviously that's even hard to talk about it when you put kids and teens together in the same group, because they are very different in how you would approach them as well. So for that reason, feel free to raise your hand and ask questions. It'll help me make sure I'm being practical for you. So the many faces of loss. As you can see, we often think of loss as loss of a parent, death. We think of loss as losing a sibling, and those are some of the most difficult ones. But loss takes on so many different forms for kids. It can be issues of disability or natural disasters, or you have school shootings that traumatize kids now, just ways where it rocks their world very differently. Things that maybe you and I didn't need to worry about as we were growing up are now concerns on a regular basis to many kids. So I'll kind of bounce back and forth between talking about death and how that impacts kids, but also talking about how there's just so many faces of loss and what that might look like. Let me tell you a short story about an example of this. At a young age, AJ experienced a complexity of loss. While his birth mother was 5 months pregnant, AJ lost his birth father in a tragic car accident. He was born to a mother who was both a prostitute and addicted to drugs. His 3 older siblings were given up for adoption immediately, and he never had the chance to meet them. A year later, his brother was born, who was a source of stability and competition for his mother's attention. His brother was a playmate, a partner in crime, his best friend, but he was also considered the baby of the family, and therefore anything the baby wanted, AJ had to give up without question. As a result of mom's unstable lifestyle, they were often homeless. They were often living in and out of shelters. They were often bouncing around to friends' house and probably not so healthy friends that they were living with or spending time with. Mom eventually gave the boys up to foster care. Didn't want to give them up for adoption, but didn't want to have to care for them. So she would pop in and out and visit them when she felt like it or was available. About a year later, she decided to get them back, and they moved back with her for about 2 weeks, and then she showed up one day at the foster care agency and said, "Here, you can take them back," and handed them back to the foster care agency. It was probably sometime 3 or 6 months after that that birth mom decided that she would allow the boys to be adopted. So AJ was adopted along with his brother. He was adopted into a family and maintained a relationship with some of his previous foster families, which was pretty helpful for him. At the age of 9, Andrew's family suffered a house fire that destroyed his home and all of his pets. He lost his family, his cats, not his family, he lost his family, cats and dogs, and all of his possessions yet again. And again, this was a cycle for him of every time he moved and was in foster care, he would lose everything he owned. Every time he moved, nothing went with him. So here in his forever home, his adoptive home, yet again he goes through another loss. Shortly after the fire, at about age 10, he was diagnosed with a progressive degenerative eye disease, which is a form of juvenile macular degeneration. So yet again, Andrew, AJ, is going through another loss. I use him as an example because it demonstrates the complexity of losses children can experience. And it also presents a struggle to know what in the world do we focus on? What is the loss he feels most pronounced? What are the things he struggles with? Because it might not be the things you and I would think that a child his age would struggle with. AJ, who I talk about here, is my son, Andrew. He is one of five children that we've adopted, and we recently, in the last, it's been a little over a year now, did go through a house fire, lost everything we owned, including our family pets. Very hard stuff. So you're going to hear me talk. I'm going to use him as an example throughout this to talk about ways in which even he started to respond to the loss. And out of five children in our home, they all responded very differently, as you can imagine. I think that's a great example, too, where temperaments are different. Developmentally, kids are different in how they will respond to it. Andrew, in particular, struggled with anger. Now, here's a kid that you wouldn't know it talking to him that he was an angry kid. He doesn't act out. He's actually a perfectionist by nature. But very few times throughout the course of the last year when I would say, hey, Andrew, what are the good things you've seen God do through our fire? What are hard things you've seen him do? And very regularly, he would say things like, well, Mom, I think it's made us angrier. And I say, well, who do you think's angry? He goes, well, I'm angry. And I thought, what an interesting response, because I wouldn't look at him and say, here's an angry kid. But yet that's what he was feeling inside. During the same year, Andrew was at school, and a note came home from one of his teachers saying that she was suddenly going to have to leave school and that the class was going to get a new teacher. So I thought, that's not good. I wonder how Andrew will take that. So just very casually, I said, so Andrew, I heard that you might be getting a new teacher. What do you think about that? And he just hung his head and said, I just keep losing things. Breaks your heart, doesn't it? It's very interesting because he can go through very hard, crisis-oriented stuff, but then a child can have something what we might perceive as minor, like switching teachers, and all of a sudden that's the thing that tipped the scales, or that's the thing that they react or act out about. So anyway, we're going to try to talk about how do we understand the layering of grief and confusion, how do we understand how kids developmentally maybe make sense out of their experiences, and then hopefully just get really practical to say, what are the key things kids really need or teens really need to help them? Responses. Here's a lot of responses that can vary from one extreme to the other. Some kids you see excessive crying or clinging, regressive behaviors. You can see poor academic performance, impaired daily functioning or inhibition. So you take a little three-year-old boy who maybe before a hard event was starting to be potty trained. Now all of a sudden he's regressing and he's not being potty trained. To a teenager who was very social and active who's now extremely withdrawn, you begin seeing behaviors that are opposite to what they were before or more extreme in nature. You see some kids withdraw from everybody. They distance themselves from their family because there's a sense of, what if I lose you too? Or they're grieving so much inside, they don't know how to respond, so they withdraw. You see another child do the exact opposite, where they are clinging to adults and they won't leave you out of their sight, and they're afraid that if I say goodbye to you in the morning, you won't come home at night. That's where you can see kids can be all over the map in their responses. That was me. Hyperactive or impulsive, angry, acting out, or replaying events. So again, if I talk about our family experience for a minute, our little guy was, I guess he would have been around two at the time of the fire. One of the things he did, and this is perfectly developmentally appropriate, is he kept seeing the same things over and over again. Now, sadly, we had about seven pets. Our kids will tell you 14 if you count fish. But we had many pets, and his way of dealing with that was to say, Mommy, Braley died? Yes, Braley died. Buddy died? Yes, Buddy died. Hazel died? Yes, Hazel died. Titus died? And he would just do that every 2 hours. Now, you can imagine how I was feeling as a parent listening to this every 2 hours in the midst of my own grief and confusion, and I just wanted to say, stop saying that. Stop saying they died. I know they died. Yes, they all died. They're all dead. But it was how he processed it. It was factual. It was this replaying of events over and over again. Now, kids can get stuck doing that. That can be problematic behavior, too. But that's, again, why it's so valuable to understand developmentally it doesn't make sense. And for him, it did. That was his way of saying, this has happened. This has happened. He wakes up the next morning. Did this really happen? This has happened. And he just continues to replay the events. So you'll often see those things. Let's talk about, we can break it up into several different categories, developmentally or physically. You see kids respond, again, sometimes kids will stop eating. Sometimes they'll start overeating because they turn to food as their source of comfort. You see regressive behaviors, you can see sleep issues or lack of energy. You see kids start having nightmares that sometimes seem related or unrelated to the events. So those could be physical or developmental reactions that happen. You also see cognitively, for a lot of kids, there's all of a sudden this inability to focus. They go to school and they're just daydreaming or checking out. They're overwhelmed emotionally. They have thoughts of their own death or what they might think or say to a person. They begin speaking out loud to the person like they're there and talking to them because it's their way of dealing with it. Emotionally, kids can respond by being numb, in shock, anxious, angry, aggressive, agitated. I mean, again, that's the hard thing is you don't know until you have the child in front of you how they're dealing with grief. And sadly, we somehow mistake that for the kids being bad, which, you know, in essence, their behavior probably is bad. But the reality is behind that is often a weight of emotion that we are misunderstanding, and that informs the way we would deal with them, right? If I know that my child's really grieving and that's the reason they're yelling at their sibling, I'm certainly going to ask them to stop yelling at their sibling, but I'm going to go deeper and meet them in their need and try to help them where they're hurting. So there's value in us really understanding what is behind some of the behaviors we see rather than just simply dealing with behaviors. Spiritually, you see a distrust of God, a sense that God doesn't care, maybe a preoccupation with heaven or hell, or a fear that God is punishing them and will punish them again. So again, it could be guilt or shame. It could be God knew I was mad at my mom this morning, and look what happened. He took her away. Or God knew this, and he did this. What a mean God he is. If you are not drawing kids out or teens out really well, we miss those things that they're thinking inside, which I'm jumping ahead of myself now, but that's part of understanding, is part of helping them heal, is by knowing what are those functional beliefs that they have going on that maybe they are or they're not expressing. Interpersonally, you see kids starting to feel different or isolated. They're reactive towards other people, or they start sabotaging relationships. And again, perhaps with teens, they do that more, especially teens that have gone through traumatic events in their family. Or again, if we pick on a loss of a parent, they don't know how to respond. And so they're angry, they're hurt, they're frustrated, they're confused. They take it out on their friends. They yell at them. They're looking for safe places to express their emotion. Someone wisely asked in the last breakout session, you have a child, perhaps, that has lost a mother or a father, and their parent who is remaining is in utter grief as well. And that remaining parent is not able to help walk their kids through their suffering because they're grieving and suffering so much. So this child not only just lost a parent, but their other parent is absent, or, for lack of a better word, neglecting them because of their own pain and suffering. And so now the child feels like, in essence, I lost both parents. Where do I find help? And that's where you see just outside resources are so important, that when we see families suffering, that we don't just assume we wait for them to help us. We engage with them and look for ways to help as well. So even developmentally, one thing to consider too is how grief ebbs and flows over the years, doesn't it? So a child who loses a parent at perhaps 4 years old is going to understand it very differently when they become a teenager, aren't they? Or when they begin experiencing proms or marriage or things where all of a sudden not having that parent there anymore matters in ways that they might not have thought before. So grief has this long-standing process that can continue, or even children that are coping and have great support and resources in their lives, if it's only there temporarily and is not there through the long haul, it can be painful and hard because there will be new things, there will be new areas to work through, and there could be new grief that comes with those things. So let me give some examples of what that might look like. Feelings about death are confusing. Sometimes kids feel okay, and other times they feel sad or scared or empty or numb. And it's really hard to make sense out of those experiences. Sometimes they're upset. Feelings can come out of bad behavior. Again, kids don't just say, "I'm really sad, I'm missing dad or mom," or "I'm really sad this happened to us." They act. They respond in their behavior. They may have trouble concentrating, paying attention, sleeping, or controlling their thoughts. Consider a child whose parent was just diagnosed with cancer, and they are consumed all day long. They go to school and think, what happens if the chemotherapy doesn't work? What happens if dad dies? What happens if this? So they come home, and when they hit the door, they begin asking these questions that they are verbalizing, but it's this obsessive, what will happen? How do I plan? How do I understand what's going on? Kids might have physical reactions like stomach aches, headaches. They feel heart pounding or breathing too fast. Again, especially when kids tend to respond more obsessively or anxiously, you will tend to see some of these reactions. Sometimes they question if they're to blame. It is amazing how often that will happen. And you will not hear kids verbalize it. So that's where it is really a skill to know what to ask or know what to look for, to say, "Honey, are you ever worried? Do you ever feel responsible? Do you ever feel to blame?" You want to be really good at drawing kids out to know what are they thinking. Anxiety can occur, fearing the same thing will happen to them or other people they love. And again, in some ways, that might be a very human reaction we all have, that once you're in a car accident, all of a sudden you're aware of being in a car accident again. You feel hyper alert next time you get on the highway. We tend to have those responses in general. It's what we do with them or how aware we are that we have those responses and what we're doing with them. Let me stop for a minute. Any thoughts or questions so far? Yeah.
One question on the earlier topic. Are those changes in behavior that you mentioned, the responses to grief, or is that, some kids have a natural tendency to lean towards some of that.
Yeah, it's definitely, you're looking for the changes that occur. And you're right, temperamentally some kids lean towards being more sober or withdrawn or more whatever fill in the blank might be, and the question is, do they become even more so? Or I can take for granted and say, you know what, my son or my child's always been that way, but if I'm not really engaging them in conversation and drawing them out, I don't know what's lying underneath that either. I don't know, though they might be presenting the same way, we never know what's really going on in the head and heart of somebody else too. So it's still really important to engage in what they're thinking and how that's coming out. So yeah. Those are changes in responses. Yeah?
You talked about having the skill to pull out information. You talked about the child feeling like they're taking the blame, and you gave an example, pretty direct, honey, are you feeling like you're to blame in this? How direct are you with those kind of questions, actually asking, are you feeling this way or that way? Typically, or are you trying to kind of nuance that?
I start out trying to nuance it, yeah. I guess it depends on how open somebody is right away, and that's probably true across the board when we're engaging people in conversation. You ask an open-ended question and you see what they give, but if you realize they're really struggling or they're stuck or they're not sure what they're feeling, then it is a loving thing to take the pressure off them and put words to that. So I'll give you a different example of that. And I counsel, I talk about this all the time, and I made the same mistake with one of my own kids where I always say kids are interpreters. They are actively thinking things. And my goal is to put those things to words. My goal is to talk about things before they're thinking about them, because I'd rather be proactive in informing how a child thinks about a subject than reactive. So issues like teaching kids about sex, issues of adoption, issues of death and dying, it is far better as adults that we are proactive than reactive. I would rather be able to inform the way a child thinks about a subject than wait for everybody else to tell them all the wrong things, and then I have to go back and debunk it. So I think that that applies here in the sense that I need to not be afraid of putting things to words, because if I'm wrong, great. And I'm probably not going to make them feel like they're to blame by asking the question. And I hope I would follow up by saying, honey, do you ever feel like you're to blame? And if they say no, I say, good, because you know what? You're not. You never could have caused this to happen, or this was never your fault. And I'm affirming why they aren't to blame, so I'm not just asking the question and letting it drop. But my kids are all adopted, and every year, at least with one of our kids, we get to visit a birth parent. And every year, developmentally, I see how she responds. And sometimes she's quieter, sometimes she's reserved. And I make the effort after every visit of saying, honey, what were you thinking? What were you feeling? And as she got older, one of the things I noticed is, you know what, I wonder if she ever thinks, boy, I wish I still lived with my birth mom. What a natural reaction that would be. But as a typical parent, I was afraid that if she was not thinking that, I certainly didn't want to put that thought in her head. So the very thing I always tell parents they should do, ask the question, put it out there, make it safe, that it's okay if you think this way and feel this. And if they don't, they'll just say no. So here I am after a visit, thinking these things, wondering if she might be thinking of it, and I don't ask the question because I'm afraid that maybe I'll be doing the very thing I tell everybody not to worry about. So we're driving home, and I'm just kind of asking open-ended questions like, so what'd you think about seeing Shannon? And so how are you feeling? And I could tell she was a little off. I could tell she felt a little withdrawn. And she was saying things like, I don't know. Do you miss her? What are you thinking? And so at some point, I just said, well, you know, honey, whatever you're thinking or feeling, it's totally okay. And if you feel like talking later, feel free. So there was my out instead of asking the question. Thankfully, later that night, she came over to me, crawled up on a couch next to me while I was doing something and said, you know, Mom, I was thinking about it. I guess sometimes I wish I still could live with Shannon. And there was the knife in the heart. And as much as I know that's natural, in a perfect world, children would be with their parents. In a perfect world, there wouldn't be adoption. There wouldn't be hard things happening to them. It was perfectly normal for her to say that and to want that and to experience that. And I should have been the mature one to put that out there for her. I should have given those words so it was safer for her to say, yeah, actually, Mom, I do feel that way. So there's a prolonged answer to what you're asking, where I think we do a service to people sometimes when we're willing to put things out there, because we also say it's safe to feel this. It's safe to have that thought. Now let's deal with it. Let's talk about it. Other thoughts? Catherine.
System, which means that they aren't willing to almost engage with their loss and their grief at all.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about how to move towards a child like that and help them to open up and almost to recognize the extent of their own loss?
Yeah, when somebody's completely blocked off or just doesn't want to talk about it and shuts down, how do you respond to it? I think, again, the weight falls on you and I to model it regardless. So I can't make them talk to me, but I can certainly talk openly to them. I can certainly say, you know, honey, I would struggle with this, and maybe you don't. Maybe this isn't a problem for you, but it would make perfect sense to be angry at God right now. And here's how people deal with that anger. And I'm talking out loud, and I'm not hopefully in lecture mode. I'm genuinely hoping to come alongside them and communicate. And it's grabbing those moments when you can. So I'm not saying, come here and sit down at the table, and I make them sit for an hour and just listen to me. We all dread those conversations, don't we? And you can even hear the tone change when someone says, come sit down with me. But instead, I'm saying things like, we're walking into a restaurant, or we get in the van, and I'm just pondering out loud, and my child doesn't even have to look at me. They can stare out the window if they want. But I am providing every opportunity. Is that Deuteronomy 6, where I'm walking alongside the way, and whether we sleep or lie down or whether they're eating dinner, I'm just opening up the conversation and saying things like, hey guys, you ever wonder why God allows suffering in the world? And all my kids would probably say, no, Mom, we're wondering what we're having for dinner. But I am opening the door for those conversations. And if one of the kids in the midst of that I know is stuck and I believe they are struggling with that, you better believe that I am connecting with them on some level, or they're listening even if they're completely shut off. So I think that goes back to what you said, where we make every effort. The weight of that should fall on us as adults to really love kids and teens and to put words to their struggles and their sufferings for them even when they can't. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's right. I never answered that. What did I say? Thankfully, as I felt the pang in my chest, thankfully I just said, you know, honey, that's perfectly normal. And in a perfect world, you would be with Shannon. But you know what? God knew that. And God takes all the hard things in our life and he works them for good. So I'm not sure why things happen the way they are, but I love you and I'm glad you're with us. And it's totally okay to miss Shannon, too. We kind of left it at that. And that's a really good point, because that is part of the struggle we have where, and now I'm getting ahead of myself in the slides, but we try to minimize their struggles by saying, well, look, you're in such a wonderful family now. Aren't I a better mom? And for one, that might not be true. Two, I'm not acknowledging the pain and the experience of the rejection she might feel by not being with birth family. So we've got to be really careful that we don't minimize. It's kind of like the example of a 13-year-old coming home who's just been made fun of at school or bullied, or they don't fit in with their class. And what do parents love to say? Don't worry, honey, I love you. Well, how many 13-year-olds actually feel comforted by that? Because, yeah, Mom, you're my mom, you have to love me. You have to wash my clothes, too, and you have to feed me dinner. So I'm so glad you love me. The reality is, hopefully it will be at some level of comfort, but it's not really addressing the rejection that they are experiencing. So we've got to be careful that we're not just trying to replace one rejection, human rejection, with human comfort, that we're actually pointing them to the Lord in the midst of that. And here's where I get ahead of myself, so let me keep moving. Another thing we're thinking through is, what is their narrative? What's the story? And here's some of the things you guys were asking just now. Find out what the child or teen's narrative is of the events or loss. How do they remember it unfolding? How do they understand it? How do they make sense out of it? What do they remember about it? It's very interesting that kids who have gone through abuse, when they're doing a forensic interview, there's a skill of, you start with the senses. What do you remember about that day? Was it raining? Was it sleeting? What do you remember smelling? What was the weather? What does it look like? And they're gradually working into the hard stuff. There's wisdom to that. Is it always necessary? No, it's not always necessary. But there was wisdom to just say, tell me what it was like the day that the tsunami hit. Or tell me what it was like the day that your family got in the car accident. And you're reliving those events in a way that give them freedom to talk about them. Not that I want kids to just be reliving them and be stuck in them, but to really be able to know that I care and I know it was hard and I want to know what you experienced and understand it better. It also gives you freedom to know what they're thinking about it. Do they blame somebody? Do they blame mom or dad or their sibling for talking too loud and distracting mom in the car? Are they stuck? Do they just keep reliving the events over and over again and they're not getting any further? then I want to know, I want to understand, well, what is true about that story, and how can I help retell the story for them? Because children interpret life and experiences whether or not we talk to them about it. If we avoid discussing something because we think it might be painful, we often at times, again, we're doing a disservice when the very thing they need to do is to talk about it and make sense out of the experience. Where do kids look for comfort? Again, kids can look for comfort in people. That makes sense, doesn't it? Our parents, they become our security blanket. You see kids wrestle. Were you going to ask a question? Oh, yes, go ahead.
What if the kid is like, good, I'm glad they're gone, and their behavior is still like normal? How do you surface if there is anything?
Let me make sure I'm understanding the question. So if they're acting normal?
And expressing that it's okay, it's good, so to speak, that she or he is gone out of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, there's several things you're saying there, so I'll try to stay on task, make sure I answer that. What grief should look like and what it does look like can be very different in our minds. And some kids, it is hard to tell, are they really handling it well? And that can be a possibility. Or are they really in denial? And so, example, you heard me briefly talk about my son after the fire. He would say he was angry. Well, initially, right after the fire, he was saying things like, well, I'm glad all the pets are dead. I don't want to have to worry about taking them out anymore. Or I'm glad my toys are gone. Now I'll get new toys. Wow, that sounds incredibly harsh and cruel. And I'm certain, looking back, he had no idea how he sounded. That was his way of trying to pretend, I don't care. I'm not going to hurt. This is okay, because now I can have better. But that the reality is we have to see back beyond that and not react to that. And we see, you know what, honey, it is okay to hurt. And I can't believe you really think that way. And or maybe you need to be sensitive because your siblings and your mom really are hurting over missing the animals. So there are ways to model. Again, I think it would go back to just modeling what might be normal reactions or not normal. If a child has lost a parent and they're saying it's okay, they're gone, then yeah, there's probably a red flag there that can't be accurate. How I'd respond, I guess, is a wisdom issue to say, do I say things like, honey, it's a big deal when you miss a parent. It's a big deal when they're not here. So it's okay if it does hurt. I'm emphasizing that normal grief says, I miss this person. It's not okay. In a perfect world, this wouldn't have happened. Why did God allow it? So I think it goes back to us putting those things to words. Oh. Okay. So children will often look for comfort. Things like people, our friends, our siblings, they're drawn to other people. Again, if a child has lost somebody or something in particular, you'll see, especially younger children, have separation anxiety. They don't want to leave. They don't want to go to school. They won't leave their parents out of their sight because they're afraid something will happen to their mom or dad. You have kids that just fantasize and daydream and zone out, refusing to go to school. Just throwing yourself into media or books or TV so you're shutting off your mind or thinking about other things. Self-soothing behaviors like thumb-sucking, security blankets, masturbating, sleeping with parents. Regressive behaviors and self-soothing behaviors where they are trying to comfort themselves. There's an interesting thought behind this as I've worked with kids and teens where, I'm trying to think how I say it, there's a secondary benefit for them. So for example, you have a child that loses a grandparent and they become really attached to their parents and they ask the parents to sleep with them. The parents say, okay, you can sleep with us tonight. But it begins to become this behavior, this pattern, or this fear of going to bed because they're afraid of going to bed. And it's a genuine fear of going to bed or something happening. So parents will let them sleep with them, or parents will put on a movie to kind of help them relax or calm them down. And that thing that we begin doing for that child becomes a secondary benefit to the child of being anxious or afraid. Because the moment they start to feel better, mom and dad turn the movie off. or the moment they start to feel better, it means they have to sleep in their own bed. So there is this unintentional secondary gain that can come when we find comfort in the wrong things. Does that make sense to everybody? And I see that a lot with kids, especially young kids, because we want to alleviate their grief, we want to alleviate their pain and suffering, and that we should. However, it can also create this dependency or this desire that, wow, if I'm upset, I get to watch a movie and stay up two more hours. Or, wow, if I'm upset, I get to sleep with mom and dad. And if I'm not upset, I have to go to my bed by myself at a normal bedtime. You can understand the dilemma for a child, can't you? So where we look for comfort. So the temptation is for children to find comfort in things and behaviors and people and relationship. And again, adults tend to offer comfort in themselves. We tend to be the answer. And the question is, what's the danger with that? Well, I think as a parent, my comfort, my ability to relieve their pain and suffering is often limited, is often flawed. Oops, let me back up a minute. My PowerPoint has taken off without me. So as a parent, my comfort is often limited, is often flawed. It's not always accessible. I can't possibly always be there for my child or my teen. It's not always accessible, and it's prone to disappoint. Where you have God's comfort that's limitless, it's perfect in its ability to comfort, it's always available, and it's incapable of disappointing. Which do I want to offer a child? There are places in a child's head and heart that God can go that I'll never be able to reach. And so my goal certainly is that I want to incarnate comfort, but I always want to point them to comfort beyond myself, that they find comfort in the Lord, that they find hope in Him, so that when I'm not there, so that when I am flawed and inaccessible and unavailable, they know that there is a God that loves them and is walking alongside them. There's another picture of what that will look like. Here's another way of saying it. 2 Corinthians talks about comforting others with the comfort we've been given, where you see the God of all comfort who comforts us so that we may comfort others and be that comfort to a child. So I'm incarnating comfort to kids. I'm incarnating loving them in a way that doesn't stop with mom or dad or counselor or friend, that I need this person, they're my security blanket that I go to, but in a way that points them beyond myself to the one who won't disappoint, the one that will always be available and go those places that you and I can't go. And that's so important. It feels in some ways like, I don't know, it feels intangible in a sense, but it makes all the difference in the world. It goes back to this this idea of kids coming home and upset over how they've been treated by their friends at school, and I say, don't worry, honey, don't care, don't worry about what they think, because I think you're awesome, I think you're special. Is that encouraging to hear? Yeah, but that's not the point, because it doesn't address the pain and the suffering. It doesn't address the hardship that they're going through in the moment. And I need to point them to some way that somewhere they can find identity, some place they can find comfort that is rooted in a place that will never disappoint, that will never discourage them. Here's some other ways of saying it. Greater is He that is in you than he that is in the world. What others mean for evil, God means for good. Do not fear, I'm with you. Have courage, don't be afraid. You are not alone. Again, we see this principle over and over that God offers Himself, that His presence is always the answer. Not promises and guarantees that bad things won't happen. And again, I think we inadvertently make that mistake as well, where we try to soothe a child's fears and say, don't worry, nobody's going to break into the house tonight. Don't worry, nobody's going to come and attack us. Don't worry, nothing's going to happen to mom and dad. chances are you are correct, but you can't make those promises. And our hope, our comfort needs to be in God being present and going before them. Dave Pallison tells this great story. Hopefully I'll tell it correctly. But he tells a time when his son was little, and his son kept getting out of bed in the middle of the night and coming in and waking them up and saying he was afraid. So David would get up and pray with them and tuck them back in and take them back to sleep. And a few minutes later, you hear little footsteps walking back over into his room. And he'd comfort him, encourage him, pray with him, take him back to sleep. And this went back and forth for several times. And around one of these times, David had said to his son, "You know what? The angels of the Lord encamp around you." It's this psalm, I think it's in Psalm 34, but it talks about the angels encamping around you. And painted this picture for his son of angels camping out at his bed and camping out at his door and hugged him, sent him back to bed. And then David said he lay there in bed waiting for his son to come back. Sure enough, a few minutes later, you hear these little footsteps come in, and his son turned to him and said, "Dad, guess what? It worked." And he went back and went to bed. I think what a sweet, sweet example of where you bring God into their struggles and you bring God to them, and that God is the answer. He is their comfort in those moments rather than us being the comfort. And it does work. Why does it work? Because it's true. And it is good, and it is right. And that is part of what we need to do for kids who go through loss, that we help make sense out of it accurately. We don't say things just to make them feel good. We don't say things to give them some sense of peace in the moment. We tell them what is true and right, even if that truth is hard to handle, even if it's painful, even if it means I don't give them comfort that this can't happen again. But I point them to the one who goes before them, who is with them, and works for their good. And so it's constantly pointing them to Christ in the midst of that. Some other ways of saying that, what's the truth? Loss is part of a broken, fallen world. They will experience it. That God's always there in the midst of the loss. Again, kids are interpreters and moral responders. They respond to things. They are making sense of their experiences. For those of you that were in my last workshop, I told the story of, again, my poor son Andrew. I'm using his as an example. He came home from school one day and had a headache. And he's a very verbal kid, so he walked around following me from room to room telling me that his head hurt. And regardless of any solution I tried to offer him, aspirin, laying down, watching TV, closing his eyes, a few minutes later he'd be following me into the next room telling me his head still hurt. I'm like, "Andrew, I don't know what to tell you, honey. Your head's just going to hurt for now, I guess. I don't know what to do." And so he left the room. A little while later he came back and he said, "Mom, I know why my head hurts." "Okay, why does your head hurt?" And he said, "Because my brain is growing, but my head's not." Think about that. And then he went and walked off. Like, all is well with the world because I figured out why my head hurt. I can't imagine it didn't stop hurting right away. That's something very interesting. He didn't care that his head would stop hurting. Well, he might have, but he actually cared more about making sense out of why his head hurt. And once he made sense out of it, although it was completely inaccurate, he was okay. And the poor kid, I never corrected his thinking because I thought it was so comical, so he probably to this day thinks that's why you get headaches. Kids are always trying to make sense out of their experiences and their world around them, and they do it without any loving guidance if we are not speaking into those things. So again, you consider a child that goes through a loss, or you consider a family that's going through a loss, and maybe the parents are struggling themselves, how hard it is then for the parents to be walking their children through or shepherding their children through that loss as well. And that, again, goes back to why the community around them is so important, why the body of Christ is so important, why just having good people that think of things to help kids are so helpful when a mom and dad are struggling themselves and not able to think of those things. They need a process and make sense out of their experiences. And again, parents are always, always key. Even if they're part of the problem, they need to be part of the solution. A parent or caregiver is going to be, in any research out there, though we should know this already to be true, will demonstrate that caregivers are the key to children being able to be resilient or to bounce back after suffering and hardships. That how we as adults help them walk through those events make a big difference. Which is why us modeling that, us knowing how to think about it and process it for them is so important. helping caregivers with helping children, and adults having a good understanding of suffering, of loss, of heaven, and God's role in it, that we bring Christ into those moments for kids, that we retell their story in a redemptive way, that we're constantly reinterpreting their experiences. So as I have a little boy who's dealing with inevitable vision loss, who has had hard things happen in his life, that I'm acknowledging that those are hard things, but I'm also saying, God is writing your story, Andrew, and he can write a story like nobody can. And it's not that it's not hard, and what you're going through isn't painful. It's that we trust the author of your story to do what is good and right. So let's pray about it. Let's trust God. What do you think God could be doing through this, Andrew? What are things you would ask God? What are things we should pray about? And you're drawing out conversation and engaging him, and you're acknowledging that, yeah, this is hard. I don't blame you for struggling with this. And I'm putting words to those things. Let me stop there for a minute. Any thoughts or questions? Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I can kind of guess at what that might be and what that might look like, but you know, some of these things, sometimes they're hard to kind of parse out and see what's really happening. So what's an example you would give of a child who's stuck?
A child who's stuck, what would that look like? Well, let me talk from a counseling standpoint, but I'll try to get more practical, too. Sometimes in counseling, I work with a lot of kids, so I'll use lots of different things like puppets or storytelling, or I have a sand tray where they'll take a car accident where a child will take miniatures and they'll just replay the car accident over and over and over and over again, and that's all they're doing. I would say they're probably stuck because they're not getting beyond that. They're not finding help. They're not able to see beyond that. Or the same thing with maybe puppets or storytelling. They just tell the same story over and over again. Or I gave the example of my little guy who kept going through all the pets dying. And you would assume that at some point that would taper off, or at some point they don't say it as much, or it happens now only once a month to every 4 months to it slowly subsides in the degree to which it happens. So you're looking for all those things to happen. If those things continue and it just seems like it's a cycle and they go nowhere and there's no resolution, that would mean they would be stuck.
And so meaning they're stuck in processing this. They don't know. They need someone to help them process. Is that what you're saying?
Process, work through it. They haven't gotten beyond it. They haven't made sense out of it. They haven't had anybody come in and felt like they're being helped. So how do you and I talk about ways where we bring help into the situation, where we offer solutions, where we give them answers or comfort that there were people there helping you, or look what happened? So again, it depends on the details of the situation, but you're trying to move them beyond that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the kinds of things that you're saying to Andrew sound very good and proper. What do you do when he says, I don't want to hear that anymore. I'm tired of that crap.
Yeah. I love him, and I say it anyway. Now, I hope I wouldn't say it in a way that I was in his face and saying, you need to hear this and I'm going to make you sit here and listen to it. There needs to be a sensitivity and compassion to those things. And I do think there's a level in which we need to let people be angry over brokenness too and the hardships that happen. So I'm careful that I don't correct the anger, that I try to understand what's behind the anger. That said, again, there's bad behavior in kids that we always correct, that we always have to adjust. But we're merciful in the way we do it. We're gracious in the way we do it. We look for what's beyond that. Let me take yours a step further, and you can tell me if this is what you're asking, but what do you do with a kid with a hardened heart, where they're just hardening their heart towards the world? Yeah. I cannot match that toe-to-toe. I've got to respond to it with grace and kindness and compassion. And I'm going to look for really winsome ways of talking to them. I'm going to try not to have the cliche language that they just want to tune out and shut me out. I'm going to look for ways of surprising them and engaging them and loving them. And that's where I believe in the work of the Holy Spirit, to change their heart, or hopefully other people to come around too. Sometimes in those moments, especially if they're responding to me as a parent, sometimes having other people come in who say the same thing, but they hear it differently. Or having people walk alongside them in new ways. So again, that's where the resources around us in the body of Christ are really helpful. Okay. Yeah.
The last point about having a good understanding of health and suffering in God's role, assuming that as an adult you do have that, how do you convey that to a child, God's role in their suffering?
Well, there's a big, broad question you just threw at me. That moves us on to here, and I do want to get practical with that because I think that's where we fail kids most. So how do you talk about eternity in ways that woo kids to it, or heaven? And I'm getting off topic a little, but sometimes kids want to go to heaven because you've done such a good job of it, or their parents there, and they're starting to talk about, I just want to die too. I just want to be with mommy and daddy. And how do you address that as well? We fail kids many, many times in issues of talking about heaven, or hard things, or prayer even. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Many kids will say, when I say to them, tell me what helps you when you're sad, or what helps you when you think about losing mom. And they'll say, well, sometimes I'll watch a movie, sometimes I pray. And I'll go, okay, well, what helps you about watching a movie? And they say, well, distraction, not thinking about it anymore. Okay, well, what helps you about praying? I don't know, it just makes me feel better. Well, we can hear somebody saying, well, I pray it makes me feel better, and think, oh, that's great, and move on to the next thing, but not realizing that actually there's nothing behind that prayer for them. It becomes another self-soothing behavior, another ritual to them, where I know this was supposed to make me feel good. It makes me feel good when mommy and daddy pray for me because I know they're loving me, they're talking to me, they're praying for me. That makes everybody feel good, right? But something gets lost there. What is it? A personal right, the source, a personal connection to a living God gets lost in that. And that child will grow up to be a teenager that doesn't believe prayer works because they don't know what they're expecting when it happens. And they're not actually praying to connect with anybody, to a living God. They're praying to feel better. But that will wear off. So I think we need to even be very careful about the cliches that we throw out and the things we tell kids, and that when a child tells us, yeah, I pray to God, that we're actually taking that a step further and saying, what does God say back to you? What do you expect him to do? What would help you? What can we expect from God? And I'm having those thoughtful discussions with kids so that I'm shaping what their expectations should be of God and prayer in the midst of that. So again, that goes to heaven as well, that we talk in concrete, winsome ways, and that we paint a picture of heaven that is beautiful and winsome and delightful, and not like sitting in a doctor's office waiting for a great physician who might give me a shot, or I'm going to be walking around all day in the daisies. How do they understand heaven and why that should be something they long for and look forward to, and why that's good that mom and dad are there? Now again, especially with the loss of a parent, we use all kinds of euphemisms that are so incredibly unhelpful, like mom and dad are watching over you. Well, think about that for a minute. That could be a little creepy, couldn't it? There's some things I don't want mom and dad to be watching. But we say things like that to make them feel better. They're watching over you, or dad fell asleep, or we lost them. We didn't lose them. But we say those things knowing what we mean, and kids can take them quite thoroughly, and they can be confused by them, or they can be afraid, well, what if I go to sleep tonight and I don't wake up if the person fell asleep? So the euphemisms we use can actually be very detrimental, and we don't think that way because we're very good about thinking in flowery metaphors with people, aren't we? And that's not a good thing to do with kids. You want to be concrete. You want to be simple. You want to be honest. But there is a weight of responsibility on us that we talk in very loving, winsome ways that draw people, that draw kids to say, wow, the way mom or dad talks about God, I want to know God. or the way they talk about heaven sounds so cool. Why wouldn't I want to be there someday? And I think that's where we fail at times in the church and in our own families. So, I don't know. Did I answer your question? Okay, good. Yeah. Yeah.
And then there they are.
Yeah.
And any suggestions? You know, like they'll say, you know, that dad and mom, when your mommy died, when your grandpa died, and he's watching over me, and you're just like, huh. You know, you want to respond to the kid, but I don't want to walk
home. Yeah, I guess depending on the context, sometimes I might not say anything. Yeah, but there are times I might say, well, how does that make you feel to think that Grandpa might be watching over you? And you think God's watching over you? And you know what? That would make me feel so good to know God is watching over me because he actually can do something to help me. He can intervene on my behalf. So I'm not necessarily saying anything negative about the euphemism, but I'm shifting focus in the midst of that. Yeah. Other thoughts or questions? Yeah. Yes, Heaven for Kids by Randy Alcorn. Yeah, that's a great book. There is an interviewer who works with kids who says, when children are not able to tell about themselves, it often has as much to do with the competence of the adults who interview children as it does the children's abilities to relate their experiences. Our takeaway from that is something I said earlier, that the weight of this should fall on you and I as adults, that we help draw kids out, that we become thoughtful, that we're willing to ask hard questions or name the hard things that they might not want to name, that we model to them not to be afraid of these things, and that we point them to something greater than ourselves. So on that note, we're done. I'll just open up for a few questions or applications. Things that we didn't talk about that you wanted to. Yeah.
I know, do you have like a list of helpful questions to teach us how to do it? I know that it's not always easy to ask open-ended questions, and I know in counseling field there are, you know, diagnostic questions that you can give to counseling. Is there something that you use specifically for kids and teens? Or can you just use the same question?
Yeah, well, yes, you can use the same questions. And yes, there's probably a list of questions that my guess is I just do naturally. And it depends on what they're struggling with or what they've lost. But one of the keys is that we give kids the freedom to remember. And I do have that in another slide we didn't get to. But there's that freedom to say, I want you to remember. I don't want you to forget. And that we broach the subject. We talk about loved ones who are gone. Or we talk about the things they lost. We put words to those things. So, again, it's us drawing them out and giving them freedom to say, let's write a letter to mom and dad. Let's write a letter to grandpa or things you wish you could say. There's such practically rich things we can do for kids in the midst of loss. Memorials and planting trees. And having memory boxes or having, life books and all kinds of photographs, things where we're saying it is okay to remember this person and we're not just going to try to forget and pretend this didn't happen. We're actually going to celebrate that God brought these people into our lives or these events and how God used them. So with modern day technology and the web out there, there are tons and tons of worksheets like that. Like I can just Google questions to ask kids who have gone through loss and you'll get tons of stuff. And then it's just the wisdom to know what are good questions to ask and how do they apply to the situation. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We will hopefully post them in the next day. And you guys can also feel free to email me and I can send them directly to you. My email is jlowe, L-O-W-E, not to be confused with jlowe, @ccef.org. Thank you guys for coming.